WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Well, with me now on Fresh Air is Lawrence Wessler, the author of a new book called Solidarity, Poland in the Season of Its Passion. It's just been published by Fireside Books. The book is based on his two trips to Poland last year, one trip in May and another that spanned September and October. His reports on Poland were first published in The New Yorker magazine, where he's a staff writer. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Is Poland of special personal interest to you?
Actually not. I mean, it has become so. I originally, last year in January, I was doing a piece for Playboy on the situation of the left in the United States, which was going to be called What's Left, and I had to go around the country and get a sense of what was going on in the left in the wake of the Reagan election at that point. And it was a very disheartening kind of trip because the answer was nothing. And there was such a lack of politics and so forth. Eventually, that particular article got spiked and never ran in Playboy. The general attitude was that there was so little going on that you couldn't even sustain interest in talking about how little was going on. But I was then on assignment for The New Yorker in Denmark in May. I was doing an article about a museum in Denmark and just on my own. Almost kind of like just to get a sense of what it's like to have politics going on, I went to Poland. I really, as of May when I went, I really didn't have any particular knowledge. And one of the things that – two things happen in a political situation like that. First of all, ordinary people start doing great things, become incredibly political. And secondly, if you come there with your eyes at all open, the world is incredibly well ventilated and you just – very quickly, if you just listen to what's going on, you get into some very deep sets of issues. And people were tremendously open. It was possible, for example, to go up to Gdansk and, you know, just within 2 hours be talking to the number two person in Solidarity, you know, just because they were very eager to talk to people. And it wasn't the kind of canned stuff you get in political reporting here. They really wanted to know what your thoughts on what they should be doing or when they wanted to tell you what they were doing and so forth. And so it was a tremendously exciting experience. And I came out of there and I had gone in without any intention of writing at all. When I came out, I sat down and I wrote a manuscript, which at that time was called 93 Visions of Poland. And it was 93 stories. I mean, it became 93 when I finished counting them up, and it was just 1, 2, 3, 4. And I wasn't really trying to lay an analysis on top, but very concretely give a kind of anecdotal sense, because that, it seemed to me that was the problem with coverage up to that point. I really didn't have a sense of what it was like on the ground in Poland. I had a sense of – and particularly at that time, especially back in May, the main reportage in the United States was almost exclusively whether the Soviets were going to invade. That's May 1981 now. And that, as one Solidarity official in Gdansk told me, he said, your American reporters are driving us crazy. I mean, in this factory right over here, and he pointed over to the shipyard, he says, one of the most amazing experiments in democratic socialism ever undertaken by anyone is taking place. And all your reporters can do is hang out there at the peninsula looking out to sea to see whether the Russians are coming. And
well, I think one of the people you spoke to suggested that maybe the reporters felt that that type of union organizing was as threatening to corporate capitalism as
well. In fairness to the people who were doing the reporting in Poland, it was all often the editors in the United States and corporate editors who. I mean, you might remember back there there was this whole period where it almost felt like Haig was saying every morning, you know, they're going to invade tomorrow morning. They're, you know, the Soviets are building up, and it almost began to seem like he was wishing that they would invade. And I really do think that what Solidarity did represent at its high point, if Solidarity had been able to work, it would have thrown into question all kinds of things about Western capitalism. And one example of that is just for starters, the most immediate one. The strike, when it took place in August 1980 in Gdansk, there was negotiations taking place across the table, and there was Lech Walesa and a few other people. And Lech Walesa, who had been an unemployed electrician 2 weeks earlier, and there he was negotiating with the deputy prime minister and so forth. But the negotiations were being piped live as they were happening over the PA system of the entire factory. The factory had been occupied by the workers This is, by the way, another kind of thing that just, I would think, terrifies Ford Motor Company and so forth, the idea that when you go on strike, the workers don't leave the factory, they stay in the factory. And this is something the Poles had learned to do over a period of years and over a period of failed strikes, and they had really learned how to do it right.
This to what prevent scabs from coming in and work?
Well, in our context, it does that. It also, in the context of Polish history, they had learned that when they left the factory, they got massacred in 1970 and so forth, and they weren't going to, you know, the factory was their stronghold. But at any rate, so you had 16,000 workers occupying the Lenin shipyards, and over the PA system, you had these very intense negotiations. And I mean, just by comparison, these recent Ford negotiations about downsizing the contract and so forth. Can you imagine? I mean, there were days where you didn't know what was happening. And they were very proud that they had a news blackout on it and so forth. And then when it was all over, that came out. Well, when you see what happens, I mean, how workers are the actual negotiation process. There was a film that was made after that, during the thing, and was released and was shown in Poland, and called Workers 80, which, by the way, is a copy has been smuggled out of the country and is going to begin to show in the United States. And I just very much recommend to any of your listeners to see that. It's one of the most incredible documentaries I've ever seen. An hour and a half of, you know, the actual negotiations, but you also see the workers outside listening in. And and at a certain point, the government negotiator says, well, you know, at one point there's this way. So this is very nice, this negotiation we're having, but don't you think it would be more effective if we went to Warsaw where we could, you know, be more closer to the party headquarters? And outside, the workers are yelling, no, are you kidding, and so forth. And Lech Walesa is rolling his rosary beads, and he says, I don't think they want us to leave, you know. And it's interesting to think if labor was in the United States that way. But that's just one example of the kinds of things that I think really did scare corporate capitals. And by the way, it's a fact that Wall Street Journal, the day of the coup, would report a couple days after the coup in December last year, reported that bankers were happy. American bankers, West German bankers were happy that the coup had taken place, that solidarity had gotten completely out of hand, both in terms of becoming somewhat anarchistic, but also in terms of, you know, it's just beginning to be a pain having this thing around.
When you first started interviewing people, the climate was pretty open. People weren't afraid of speaking openly about what they were doing. They said to you, use my name and make sure you spell it correctly.
Right.
And you chose not to use their names. Are you glad now that you didn't?
Well, I mean, the rule I followed was that if it was someone who was known as a core leader and so forth, or solidarity leader, I would use their name. But you know, this was the decision I made was back in November when we were running it in the New Yorker. And at that point, I was really haunted because they'd said, use our names. We want our children to know that we were doing this and spell it right, you know. And I guess already in November, the way the book is presented and the way the articles are presented, there's a section on May and what life was like then and a section on September. And I think the section on September is already very dark and so forth. I don't think I was any special person to have had a premonition that things were coming to unravel at that point. And I did not use their names, and I know that many of them wish I still had, even ones who are in prison and so forth, that they would have wanted their kids to know. But I don't have as much nerve as they do.
Have you been able to keep in touch with people who you met there?
I've kept in touch with some through roundabout ways. I get absolutely wrenching letters occasionally. For the people who do know the pieces in The New Yorker, I'd say about half of the people that I interviewed are currently in jail or in detention camps at least. Many of the people I get these absolutely elaborate letters on, you know, strategies for getting out, you know, and I mean, one I got a few days ago from a film director who was saying how he was going, I should do this and this and this that would help him to, on his side, do something. But beyond that, he would then divorce his wife and send an American or an Englishman into Poland to marry his wife, and then they could be reunited a few years from now on the outside. I mean, you know, these heartbreaking, really horrible stories. But
do you feel any responsibility to try to follow through on plans that your friends suggest to you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I feel a general responsibility to bear witness on Poland and in particular, to do whatever I can. In fact, there's a movement which I hope will begin to surface fairly soon. I know there is a solidarity support group in New York City that has a list of 4,000 detained people on a computer readout. And what they're trying to do, among other things, is get the occupations and then, in effect, have a kind of adopt-a-prisoner program so that, like, the United Auto Workers should adopt the detainees from the Ursus tractor plants, and the poets, essayists, novelist Penn should adopt writers, and film directors should adopt film directors, and so forth. And in a somewhat Amnesty International type fashion, just adopting means, you know, just making focusing attention on them and so forth. And that, in a general way, should be done. And short, until that happens, people who know people really have to be watching out for them.
Well, when you were in Poland talking to a lot of members of Solidarity, what kind of bond did they feel with the American labor movement?
Well, it was the second trip had a particularly interesting situation because the PATCO strike had just happened here in the United States, and Reagan had gutted the air traffic controllers union, and the Polish government was going nuts and saying, "You guys can't strike here. I mean, look, even in the United States, they don't let you strike against the government, and you know most of the workers in Poland are working for the government, so in effect, and this one man pointed to his badge. We were talking. I was asking him about PATCO, and he said, you know, PATCO has nothing to do with our arrogance. It has totally to do with the inadequacy of American labor. If American labor had been organized as we're organized, it wouldn't have happened. And he pointed to his badge. He said, look at my badge. What does it tell you? It tells you my name, and it tells you my region. From my badges, you can't tell me whether I'm an editor, a coal worker, a shipbuilder, a nurse, you know, all you know is where I come from. We are organized by region. American labor is organized by trade, and it's a lot easier to bust unions when they're organized by trade than by region because, you know, they had tried to do that with us. And in fact, a few weeks later, they tried to fire a whole group of airline pilots, and the country almost came to a stop over it. Now, fascinating upshot of all this, which has happened in the meantime, is that the military regime, when it says that it's going to allow something like Solidarity to happen, this is a Communist Party military regime, says that in the future, any trade union that develops will be organized by trades, not by regions in Poland. They'll be organized like every other trade union in the world. And then this man who is the Communist Party spokesman says, I mean, what interest do a shoemaker and a shipbuilder possibly have in common? I mean, this is the era of Workers of the World Unite, Karl Marx making that kind of position now. But it gives a sense of how ironic things have gone there.
You quoted, I guess it was a sociologist who said to you that people in Poland are so used to the communist slogans they've started to believe them.
I mean, this is something that was very important. I mean, there was a tendency, I think that's pretty much been washed away in the meantime, but there was an early tendency on the part of a lot of people in the United States to think that what Solidarity was after was a reinstitution of capitalism in Poland. And it definitely was not that. It was a tremendously egalitarian movement. There were all kinds of word games that went on around the word socialism. Thus, for example, the party was going to be allowed to have political functions, but the union would have social functions, is what they would say. And when you'd ask people, what do you mean? What's a political function? They'd say, the kind of thing the party worries about. And you say, what do you mean by a social function? Oh, you know, press, you know, redistribution of income through the society. Everything was basically social. And there was a whole period where people would say, Solidarity represents society. Society wants this. So, I mean, there was a period of 16 months roughly up till the end of, let's say, the first 10 months of it anyway, where you really could say society wants this. And how did you know? Because Solidarity said so. And Solidarity was society. And what Solidarity insisted on was social ownership of the means of production. So, I mean, they really were after socialism as opposed to what they considered to be anti-socialist, which was state ownership, and which is the Communist Party version. But right at the heart of all this was a tremendous egalitarian spirit. And I'll just tell you two stories to bring it out. One of them is that all the wage demands, whenever there were demands for wage increases, were for across the board set amount. So that means, for example, that – and this is, by the way, a demand that was initially made by some of the best paid workers in Poland, the ship workers who were relatively well paid in Gdansk. So that means that if they were negotiating a pay increase, it would be 1,000 zlotys per month for every worker, so that somebody who was earning 6,000 zlotys a month suddenly had a rather sizable increase, and somebody who was earning 20,000 zlotys a month had, you know, just a small increase. The richers had less, obviously, which is, by the way, the exact opposite of the Reagan tax plan, which is a percentage across the board cut so that rich people get huge cuts and poor people get, you know, $5, $10 or something. And that was just taken for granted. I mean, they just had this kind of feeling. Another thing that was one of the most touching things I saw was that when I was there in May, there was at one point a desperate cigarette shortage. Everybody in the country smokes. As somebody said to me, if you'd lived here the last 36 years, you'd smoke too. You know, but basically everybody was running out of cigarettes. And in retrospect, or at the time, people were thinking it was partly government plots to put everybody on edge, you know, just hoarding cigarettes or whatever it was. But in any case, you'd be walking down the street with somebody who was smoking a cigarette and had two cigarettes in his pack and didn't have any more cigarettes. And somebody, a complete stranger, would come up and bum a cigarette off him, and he would give it to him. He would give him his last cigarette in his pack, knowing full well that two blocks down, when he wanted a cigarette, if he saw someone smoking, he could go up to that person. That person wouldn't give him. It was like the society had made a decision: we are not going to have, you know, we're not going to start groveling about cigarettes. We're going to, you know, share this thing until this peters out. As I say in my article, the problem was that nobody could find any matches at that point. I try to be balanced in the book in terms of I try not to be sloganeer about the Communist Party and about because it's very complicated. But it really does seem to me that there are certain positive highlights to what 36 years of communism has done in that country. And one of them is it really has given this kind of egalitarian spirit. Generally speaking, I'd say, by the way, that you know, a lot of us had a tendency to kind of look over there condescendingly and say, gee, isn't this quaint how they're trying to learn democracy here, you know, and so forth and so on. What the workers in Poland were doing for 16 months was, you know, decades ahead of anything the United States has ever tried. You know, and who knows how long before we'll ever get near there. And they were on the edge of some very, very important experiments. And one thing that you have to go in right away is to get rid of the condescension and to go in there in a situation really kind of trying to understand what their problems were, their crises, how they faced them, understand why they failed at the moment they failed, and so forth. But
Poland's like become a symbol to many different groups of people in this country. Are you watching that?
Oh yeah, sure. It's very, very frustrating to watch the kind of symbol it's come to some people. I mean, the whole "Let Poland be Poland" cabal was rather shocking. I mean, in fact, I was talking with one woman, Jerry Labor, who heads the Helsinki Watch Committee in New York, and her job. I mean, what she does principally is that she watches out for human rights violations in Eastern Europe and recently especially in Poland. And she had just gone to the Madrid conference to be an observer at the Madrid conference that was reviewing the Helsinki Accord, whether the Helsinki Accord on human rights was being followed. And obviously Poland was a big issue. And she said to me that the biggest problem she had as an American trying to argue with Europeans that they should have more vigilance about what's going on in Poland and with just people in the world, she said El Salvador. She said, you know, what they come back at you is saying, you know, it's no use listening to you about anything. You Americans who are concerned about Poland, I mean, our biggest problem in trying to organize around Poland is that the Russians come at us and say, this is just how big powers behave. Look at the United States with El Salvador. And if you want to do anything to help the Poles, you got to confront that kind of behavior in the United States. And I guess it's a long way around of saying that a person whose foreign president and secretary of state whose foreign policy includes what's going on in El Salvador is in no position to champion what the workers in Poland were trying to do.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. Lawrence Wessler is my guest, and he's written a book called Solidarity, Poland in the Season of Its Passion. And it's based on two trips to Poland, one last May and one in September and October. And his reports were initially published in the New Yorker magazine. Let's talk a little bit about the church and the Communist Party in Poland. You say that in the battle between Catholicism and communism for the hearts and minds of the Polish people, only Catholicism was really able to tap in and express Polish nationalism. And you say that
it's a absolutely unique situation, and it's a situation that's very confusing to most Americans. I mean, I get a lot of people saying, you know, they're not quite sure what to think of solidarity with all these, you know, papists and papists or however you pronounce it. You know, or is it really some, you know, ecstatic religious group rather than a political group and so forth? I mean, I went in there really not knowing. I mean, for starters, I went in there with the assumption, well, people don't really go to church that much and so forth. And that's not true. They do go to church. I would talk to students at the university, not from the country. I mean, urban, who lived in the, you know, and 80-90% went to church every Sunday. I would, but what you have to understand about it is that that what has happened uniquely in Poland and nowhere else in Eastern Europe is that communism, the Communist Party, more so than any other place, was imposed on the Poles after the war. I mean, for example, in East Germany, the Communist Party was an authentic anti-Nazi organization. They had led the leadership, you know, led the resistance. In Czechoslovakia, there was a curious election of some sort, but there was a plurality of people who had, you know, at one point supported something like communism. In Poland, it was imposed as part of Stalin's national security considerations after the war. And in fairness to the Soviet Union, they had just lost 20 million people on their – I mean, that's a figure that Americans should just try to understand. We – you know, I mean, what is that, 100 times? Is it – yeah, 100 times as many people as the Americans lost in World War II were lost by the Soviets and lost on their western border. And, you know, Stalin was not about to have some kind of romantic, potentially anti-Russian – there's age-old hatred between Russians and Poles at predates well before communism was introduced to either place. So he imposed this system on. But Poland was quite Catholic at that point. Nothing like it is today, by the way. One of the things that communism has done for Poland is it's given the Catholic Church a second virginity. It's really quite amazing. But this alternative institution organized almost as a government, I mean, in pastorships and bishoprics and so forth, was there and became completely identified with Polish national traditions and so forth. By the way, another thing you have to understand about Catholicism in Poland is that you've got – historically, you've got this group of people surrounded on the one side by Protestants in Germany and Russian Orthodox in Eastern Orthodoxy on the other side. And these Catholics kind of separated from the rest of – their hearts are kind of in Europe, but they kind of huddle together for out of that. And by the way, also that you have to understand about Poland that for the last 200 years of its history, it's really only been independent as a state, even existed as a state for 20 years between the two world wars. That the rest of the time it's been this kind of people longing for a state, and they would express that longing through their devotion to the church. I spoke with a perfectly agnostic social scientist who told me that he sent his, you know, 5-year-old son to church every Sunday and so forth. And I said, why do you do that? And he says, if my son didn't go to church, school, he would never ever understand any Polish poems. And it's become that tied up. Now, the flip side of it is you ask, you know, the same woman at the college, what do you do about birth control? And does it have any impact on you? Oh, that's a completely different issue, you know. And of course
she
ignores it. And abortion is the principle, you know, very wide open and so forth. And there, I was walking with this woman and they were having displays on creationism versus Darwinism. And, you know, she said, well, you know, it's just stories. And you know, they're kind of fond of it. They kind of say that, this, you know, the church has to do this because, you know. But what the church does has done, this whole underground organization in effect, I mean, or unofficial, it's not underground. I mean, it's fought for its existence in a way, has been to preserve this kind of sense of history, of the alternative history, so that, you know, in church people would learn about what had happened in the strike in 1956 in Poznan, in Gdansk in 1970 and so forth. And so it's very, very tied up. Part of that also is that Solidarity is John Paul's ascension to the papacy and in papacy. Let's see if I can get that word right. Anyway, in 1978 and his subsequent visit in 1979 were tremendously important in kind of more than anything else in galvanizing Polish imagination. I mean, one of the things we'll talk about, I suppose, more is that Poles have two streaks running side by side. One of them is this fathomless desolation. They always lose. They always lose. I mean, it's a history of just losing all the time. And the other side by side is this flame of idealism and, you know, hope that comes out of that desolation and sometimes bursts forth and then gutters out and so forth. But in a way, I think the flame got lighted more than anything else on this most recent round by John Paul's elevation. They were saying, kind of saying, you know, wait a second, you know, all the Catholics in the world are listening to a Pole. Why do we have to be, you know, we don't always lose. Look, we just won a big one here. And so the pride that they felt in the Pope was just they didn't have to settle for or mediocrity, which is what they felt they were settling for. By the way, also within this whole thing is that you got, because there was this situation, the Communist Party was never able to achieve legitimacy. I mean, there's been a question of legitimacy of the Communist Party in some of the other countries, and it's been tenuous and so forth. And I would say increasingly in Eastern Europe, there's very little left at all. But in Poland, they never achieved any kind of legitimacy. So in fact, they became more and more insular and more corrupt just because there was no organic connection to the working class in Poland and because the working class was devoted to the Catholic Church.
I know you were interested also in the subject of anti-Semitism in Poland. You pointed out there were like 30% of the population before World War II.
30% of the population in Warsaw. 10% of the population in the country. Right. 30% of the urban population. Yeah.
Was Jewish before the war, and now it's 2%, is it?
Oh, much less. It's very complicated, actually. It's a very... one of the things that Poles will tell you, without a moment's circumspection, without a moment's irony, is that one of the principal things that made Solidarity possible was that the country is 99% ethnically pure. And that, they say that just purely descriptively. They say, you know, no other country is as pure. Like in Spain, there's all these different types of Spaniards, and you know, but we are pure. And it's like it's said to you without any bad conscience about what has been involved in becoming that way. Because in 1939, as we said, 30% of the population of Warsaw was Jewish, 10% of the population of the whole. During the war, the vast majority of the Polish Jewish population was wiped out by the Nazis. There is considerable evidence that the Poles were less than heroic in their attempts to save the Jews. It's an understatement, and there are many Polish Jews here who will tell you that, you know, that the Poles were perfectly happy to see the Jewish population wiped out.